and RNA can be sequenced, and this allows us to inspect the sequences composed of their respective bases. After the process of transcription, but before or concomitant with the process of translation, a process called splicing occurs, which alters this RNA product, and I will describe that more in a moment. So we are leveraging genome sequencing data from the Cancer Genome Atlas in order to define mutated and stable genes and dysregulated metabolic pathways in solid tumors. And the motivation for this is that there is a failure of currently available methods to correctly categorize gene variants of uncertain significance, despite the substantial potential of some of these variants to be pathogenic. And in order to do this, we are using mutations in coding and non-coding regions that are present, typically near exon-intron boundaries. And these are taken after mRNA processing, and that can these mutations can result in aberrations in splicing, which I'll describe in a moment. So overall, this represents a typical gene, and you can see that genes are composed of exons and intronic segments. The exons are those that actually code for the final protein product, and introns are removed or excised prior to the formation of the protein, so they don't code for anything. There are some important junctions, in particular between the intron and exon, and there's the 5' splice site or the donor region, and the 3' splice site or the acceptor region. So typically, after these introns are removed, exons are ligated together to form a wild-type gene, as shown here. Current genomic studies mainly assess the marked regions, and that's only near the boundaries of these introns and exons. And that's really a limiting factor and doesn't allow us to observe and inspect the totality of mutations that can cause splicing defects. Software developed in our lab, called the Shannon Pipeline, allows us to assess the entire gene length for the presence of these splicing mutations. So there are a variety of splicing consequences that can occur from these various mutations. One of these is so-called exon skipping. And sorry for the color being a bit off here, but this can occur when there is a mutation at both the intron-exon junctions, acceptor and donor sites of a given exon. And when these are causing these splice sites to be abolished, which is to say not recognized by the biological machinery, what that can cause is this exon to not be recognized as a coding region at all, and it cannot be included in the final transcript. If this occurs, you would have just the exon previous and after to it. In this case, exon 2 is skipped. Another possibility is intron inclusion or intron retention, and this can occur when you have an abolishing or weakening mutation at the donor or acceptor site, and that can cause an intron to actually become included, and in this case, we're talking about instances in which the entire intron is included in the final transcript. Finally, we have so-called cryptic splicing, and this can occur with a mutation in either an exon or an intron, and this can cause a non-canonical or cryptic splice site, where you have a splice site other than the natural site. And what this does in this example is it causes the exon to be spliced prematurely, so you have exon truncation. Another possibility is to have it, say, for example, here, and then the exon would be elongated by this cryptic site. So overall, the Shannon pipeline outputs a set of putative variants. And these variants require empirical confirmation in order to begin the process of translation into clinically relevant insights. And in order to do this, you can inspect RNA sequencing data in order to check, did this mutation in the DNA data actually cause some of the previously articulated splicing consequences? And we can do this manually using software called IGV from the Broad Institute, but it's extremely time-consuming to do so, and it wouldn't be possible to do so overall when we have such a large number of samples. And it's difficult to do so in a way that is not statistically biased. So these mutations in the DNA are being corroborated by the RNA sequencing data because it's from the same patient. So that's what gives us the power to do this. So overall, our objectives were to develop a method to automatically validate putative DNA sequencing variants that alter mRNA splicing in multiple patient samples using corresponding RNA sequencing data. And from this, we wanted to derive novel biological insights from breast carcinoma data through a more in-depth analysis of these splicing mutations. So overall, before doing this, we need to obtain our input. And items outlined like this in orange are data obtained from the Cancer Genome Atlas. And items outlined in, well, purple, but here it appears as blue, are things for which we have PEARL programs to automate this procedure. So we obtain our set of input variants by getting matched tumor normal DNA sequencing data from TCGA. We then get somatic variants, that is to say variants that are present in the tumor sample, but not within normal tissue. And we use two programs, Strelka and Somatic Sniper, to do this. Then we cull splicing mutations from this data using the Shannon pipeline. And finally, we filter and format this data for input into our program called Veridical. We also obtain RNA sequencing data from the same patient and a RefSeq exome annotation, which just tells us where the exomes are for each gene. So overall, the way we can use RNA sequencing data to validate splicing mutations is shown here. Here we have a gene on the bottom, and you can see these exons are the thick blue boxes and introns are the thin lines between them. And then we have here reads, which is RNA sequencing data, and these thick gray boxes are areas in which these reads align to the respective portion of the genome. Thin interconnecting lines represent areas which span a region. So for example, here, this aligned to here, and this area aligned to here, but this is a single contiguous read. So overall, what we expect is shown here. Because this is an intronic region, we expect this area to be spliced out, so there should be no reads for this region. What we do not expect, but observed in a lot of cases, is this significant intron retention. This indicates that this entire intron has been retained in the final transcript, as shown here. So normally you have exon, intron, exon, but here you have this entire region being retained. And it turns out that this, in this example, it's being caused by this G to A mutation, which we are able to detect. And this G to A mutation, you can see, is present in every single one of those reads that goes into the intronic region. So that very strongly corroborates that this mutation causes this observed splicing consequence. So overall, we have two types of evidence types that we use. We have junction spanning reads, which are those that span an intron exon junction, and we have read abundance reads, which are those that do not span a junction. Now here you can see a normal junction spanning read. You can see that this aligns to the junction of the natural splice form. That's what we expect. Here you can see a mutated junction spanning read, which is corroborating the presence of this cryptic splice form. So this is the natural splice site. Here there was a cryptic splice site which caused this to be extended to here. And this read is confirming that that was present. Also, this read abundance read also confirms the presence of this cryptic isoform, whereas this one is showing that there was some intron inclusion here, because it's within the intronic region of both sets of transcripts. So overall, this method allows us to take a hypothesis-driven approach to statistically validate variants. And you can see some examples here. There's cryptic splicing, where we have, again, an extension of this exon to here, and you can see that all the cryptic reads had the mutation that causes the cryptic splicing to occur. Here in the gene MLL5, you can see some exon skipping, where the exon's completely skipped, or significant intron retention, as shown here. Overall, it's important to note that the reason we were able to do so in a statistically powerful way was by leveraging a number of control samples, over 500 such samples. Over 100 of these were normal tissue samples, but the rest were tumor samples, which we were able to use if they didn't contain the variant in question. So any tumor sample without the variant was used as a control sample to assess ones which did have the variant. So overall, the data ends up looking like this, for example, for intron inclusion. And this is just the frequency, a histogram of the frequency of intron inclusion. And you can see how much intron inclusion the variant-containing sample had here, and this would be a p-value of less than 0.01. But you can see this data is highly non-Gaussian. So this is a problem. We wanted to apply parametric statistical methods because they're more powerful, and they don't have certain tacit assumptions that are present in non-parametric methods, which we weren't certain we'd be able to meet. So in order to do that, what we did is we used the Yeo-Johnson power transformation. And this transformation allowed us to transform the data to be Gaussian. And then you can see that in normal tissue samples, already the blue is the untransformed data, purple is the transformed data. And you can see the similar histogram that it would have been sufficient to simply use no transformation whatsoever. However, in tumor samples, there's a significant deviation from a normal distribution. And the Yeo-Johnson corrects this and allows us to use a simple Z test. So overall, we have our input. We then go through Veridical. We extract reads from the relevant region. We count these reads based upon their splicing consequence and evidence type. We then use the Yeo-Johnson transformation to allow us to use the Z-test and then report and filter by statistical significance. Just for time, I'm going to skip over another example. So overall, it's important to note that we are not considering the problem of alternative splicing. That is, we're not trying to annotate the genome and say which genes are normally alternatively spliced, nor are we trying to derive sets of putative variants. What we are trying to do is hypothesis test that a predicted mutation affects RNA splicing. And we're leveraging existing variant predictions and exome annotations in order to do so. So overall, in terms of performance, it's roughly linear in terms of the number of BAM files and variants. BAM files are just those that contain the input RNA sequencing data. And so you can see in these effect plots using a linear regression, again, that it is roughly linear. And it's also linear in terms of memory, our program, with respect to the number and size of the input RNA sequencing data. So overall, we were able to find a much larger number of splicing mutations than the TCGA consortia was able to find. In particular, we were able to find over 5,000 such mutations, where they found less than 500, and we were able to validate a substantial portion of these. So just briefly to conclude, this provides a general hypothesis-driven approach that could be done in any disease. While we applied it to breast carcinoma, it could be done in general. And it can aid in formulating biological insights, which I didn't have time to get into detail here, but there are a number of interesting results that came out of this analysis. And known breast cancer genes may be mutated in a higher percentage of tumors than are currently being reported, and splicing mutations are more prevalent than those being currently reported. And I don't have time to discuss the future work, of which there is a significant amount. And I'd just like to acknowledge my supervisor, Dr. Peter Rogan, as well as the other members of my lab, and especially Stephanie Dorman, with whom I worked on this project. Thank you.
Great, we have time for some questions. This might be the only question I could ever ask at a conference like this. I don't really understand this field at all, but you have a similar problem that we have in psychology, is these distributions that are not normal, and they preclude us from using traditional statistics, although people do it anyway, and this is becoming a very large problem in terms of the stability of the results. And a lot of times, at least I feel like I can't believe what I read in literature sometimes, because you're using these tests that are really not appropriate. And so you have a similar problem where you have these non-normal distributions, and you've chosen to transform it. Have you heard of bootstrapping, which is a non-parametric test that uses resampling to force normality on the data? It's used, and it increases power, it increases the accuracy, the confidence intervals, and all that kind of stuff, more so than doing the transform of the distribution.
So
I was wondering if that's possible.
I have, and what I would say is that in this instance, this is a better approach because, firstly, bootstrapping would take a bit longer computationally. Although not significantly so. But the main reason to avoid bootstrapping in this instance is because we have so many samples and we have such a large set of controls, and we're able, therefore, to use a Z-test. It's not like we're instead using a T-test. We're able to directly compute the standard deviation. And it makes sense, therefore, to transform the entirety of our data set. And so while bootstrapping would, in general, allow more power, there are also, depending upon the bootstrapping method you use, sometimes other assumptions that can be introduced. So in other words, yes, you don't need a normal distribution, but you might make certain assumptions regarding the null hypothesis, that the null hypothesis is the same in your control data set as in your experimental data set. And almost always, especially in the field of psychology, I believe this would be true. These things are usually true, but in this case, we weren't certain of that. And so we wanted to avoid such statistical subtleties and instead stick to parametric statistics.
One last thing, if I could, they weren't scatter plots, but you fit a line to some data as well, right? And you have confidence intervals around the line.
You mean here?
No, they're just like a X and Y, and then you had a line with the bent confidence interval around it. It's like near towards the end.
Oh, that's just for the performance.
Okay, so another thing is, like, what's the actual shape of the data?
Right, so these have nothing to do with the data themselves. This was just me showing more directly the actual performance of the algorithm.
Okay.
So this is just time versus the number of input files and
okay.
time versus the number of variables.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, this would make no sense for the data.
Okay, certainly. Thank you.
Great, any more questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.